We were becoming a team, no longer 14 individuals with 14 agendas. And the angrier we were at him for making us run, the more we bonded with one another. Before long, we realized that we could achieve more than we ever thought was possible. Coach Calhoun was similar to Coach Smith, making sure we didn't give up when giving up would have been easy. And even if there were times I felt he went too far, I didn't say a word. I was already in a battle with myself every day on that court. Give up just once, and I might give up again and again. A few did give up, as you would expect, eventually transferring to other schools. I could have predicted who they would be by how they complained instead of doing what they were told to do. They assumed that because they were talented, they merely had to show up. Not under Coach Calhoun. To be on his good side, no simple feat. You had to work hard in practice, make it to class on time, show up at study hall, and guess what? Do it all over again the next day. That reminds me of my first practice. After it ended, Coach Lato saw something he didn't like. "Coach," Lato told Coach Calhoun, "the freshman didn't sweat. He obviously didn't work hard enough." Was he messing with me? I had worked extremely hard. The reason I didn't sweat was because the gym was air-conditioned, and I was used to the humidity from being in the South. I worked so hard I was dying to get a drink of water, only to be stopped by Kevin Ollie, a teammate. "Stay away from that water bottle," K.O. warned. "You can't just drink water whenever you feel like it. He's got to tell you that you can get it." In any case, I have no idea whether Coach Calhoun ever responded to Coach Lato about my not sweating enough. I hurried off the court and did not turn back. Off the court, the closeness I saw between the players during my visit the year before was genuine, and being part of a group for the first time since I was a boy in California meant the world to me. I would do anything for my new friends. Take the party underneath the student union freshman year, which a lot of football players attended. Not good. The football players at UConn always seemed to be envious of the basketball players. There were 14 of us, roughly 50 of them, and we received most of the attention. There was a dispute over, what else? Some girl, and being the mature grown-ups we were, we decided to settle it with our fists. I was ready. It wasn't as if I'd never been in a fight before. Except my teammates didn't want my help. "Get out of here," they said. "Go back to the dorm." "No, no, let's do it," I pleaded. Their reasoning was this. It was one thing if we got in trouble. We were known for not always behaving well. Yet if Coach found out that Ray, who had a stellar reputation, was involved, he was really going to make us pay. I certainly did not seek any special favors. But then I thought, these guys hold me in high regard, and I should respect that. On the other hand, there was one thing I wouldn't do with them. That was drinking. Were there times I wished I could have joined them? You bet. Until I saw them throwing up on the street or hung over the morning after. To their credit, not once did they make me feel bad for staying away. They knew I was doing what was right for me. If I didn't succeed in basketball, I wanted it to be because I was not good enough, not because I drank too much. I thought I was good enough, although I couldn't be certain. Not until the second game of the season against Virginia in Charlottesville. Virginia, if you remember, was the school that sent a letter indicating they were no longer interested in recruiting me. I was eager to show them what they were missing. Members of my family also made the trip from South Carolina, and I didn't want to disappoint them. How motivated I was, though, wouldn't influence Coach Calhoun one bit in deciding on the amount of playing time I'd have. He had a game to win. A big game. The Cavaliers were ranked number 12 in the nation. We were unranked. Beating them on their court, no less, would make a statement. Loud and clear. UConn, 77. Virginia, 36. No one saw it coming, although I couldn't be sure if they were that bad or we were that good. We pressed them on every possession, and they couldn't adjust. I scored 20 points off the bench, while the other reserves also played well, which was a welcome sign. In the first game of the year against Towson, we won by 40. But that was because our starters dominated. You can't count on that game after game. Sooner rather than later, the bench would have to come through. I saw no reason why the bench couldn't be as integral to our success as the starting five. I felt that strongly about every team I was on. One of those starters was Duran Shepherd, a 21-year-old freshman from Israel. I'll never forget the first time I saw Duran. I was shooting baskets in the gym when he walked in. He was 6'5", the same height I was, and also a guard. My immediate thought, they have me. What do they need this guy for? I wasn't threatened so much as driven to prove myself. Coach would start the one who was playing the best, and I was confident that would be me. And though it turned out not to be me, I didn't mind one bit. Duran made us better, and that's what mattered. He averaged about 12 points and 5 assists a game, and was the Big East Freshman of the Year. Besides, I was contributing as well, averaging 12.6 points. And when we were on the court at the same time, we clicked. Duran would drive past his defender and throw the ball to me in the perfect spot, and that makes a big difference in getting up a good shot. I never forgot to work hard, though a reminder here and there didn't hurt. Like the time I was in the gym the first month and saw Danielle Marshall, our best player, and Scott Burrell, who had left school the year before and had been drafted by the Charlotte Hornets, shoot jumper after jumper. I couldn't take my eyes off them. They didn't miss. How could I be that consistent? I knew the answer, of course. Practice, practice, practice. Another time I was taking a few shots, some as I stood still, others as I jumped, while Carl Hobbs, one of our assistant coaches, watched closely, until he had seen enough. Young fella, he said, you just can't shoot a standstill shot and not jump, because now you're going to go against 7-footers who will be able to block your shot. You have to shoot the same way every time. What Coach Hopp said helped enormously. From then on, I made sure that I jumped whenever I took a shot. My shots were rarely blocked. The win in Charlottesville put us at number 21 in the nation. Did we deserve it? It was too soon to tell. I did, however, find out something else important that night. I found out what people in South Carolina thought of me, and it was what I suspected. I didn't know you were good, Rosalind said when I saw her briefly afterward. She quickly corrected herself. I mean, I knew that you were good, but I thought you were good for Sumter, South Carolina, just better than the guys around there. I didn't know you would be this good at this level. People told her I'd be back in 4 years, and that no one from Dalzell ever amounted to anything. She believed them. I wasn't angry with her, not in the least. Besides, by this point, Rosalind and I were beginning to grow apart, even if a formal breakup was a ways off. It wasn't that we didn't love each other, but it's extremely difficult to maintain a long-distance relationship at that age especially. I could not go 50 yards on campus without running into a girl I wished I could have gotten to know better. If only I wasn't involved with someone else. As for the team, another key test came on the road against Seton Hall. I was looking forward to it, but not just the game itself. I was excited about the trip to the game. Soon after our bus crossed Connecticut into the state of New York, there it was. The Big Apple, as magical as I imagined it. I gazed out the window and couldn't believe it. There were actual living, breathing New Yorkers on the streets, and I wanted to get out and walk with them and talk to them for a little while, to be one of them. But before I knew it, we were driving over the George Washington Bridge, heading to New Jersey where Seton Hall is located. I kept looking behind me at the skyline until we arrived at the hotel in Secaucus. Seeing the city would have to wait. I was scared to death leading up to the game. This was the Big East, the big time, the stage I asked for, and now it was here. Yet once I stepped onto the court, the anxieties disappeared. The court was the same as any, and my responsibilities the same. Get open, make shots, and stop the man I was guarding. Mission accomplished. The final, Connecticut 82, Seton Hall 66. I scored 17 points, 13 in the second half. By late December, we were 7-0, ranked number 14. I couldn't figure out for the life of me why this team had struggled so much the season before. The only theory that made sense was that our year's leaders, Kevin Ollie, Danielle Marshall, and Donnie Marshall, no relation, were more determined than the year before's. We're not losing anymore, they vowed. We know our way around, and we're going to make something out of these last 2 years of college. In any case, off to Hawaii we went for a holiday tournament to extend our winning streak, to move up higher in the rankings, to enjoy a little sunshine, to fall flat on our face. After knocking off the University of Texas Arlington, we lost to that powerhouse from the Mid-American Conference, Ohio University, 85-76. Having Donnie kicked out with 7 minutes left in the first half didn't help our cause, but that was no excuse. We stunk up the joint, simple as that, missing open shots, committing turnovers, getting out-hustled for every loose ball. Not to let us off the hook, but Ohio was a much better team than people realized. They had a good point guard, and a 6'8", 250-pound power forward, Gary Trent, known as the Shaq of the Mac. The nickname was appropriate. He was an absolute beast. We tried everything we could, including hacking the guy. Nothing worked. The loss, as it turned out, was what we needed. We'd become a little cocky. I don't recall us even having a scouting report on them. The next day in Hawaii, we started another streak with a win over Tennessee Tech. This streak would reach 10, carrying us to number 5, before a loss at Syracuse in early February. 7 of the 10 came in the Big East, including a win over St. John's in the Garden. At last, I was able to spend time in the city that never sleeps. The rest of the guys also couldn't wait to do some exploring. Not, however, until we heard from our camp counselor, Coach Calhoun, who summoned us to his hotel room. "This is the best city in the world," Coach told us. "It's going to be one of the greatest experiences of your life." With $60 in our pockets, the cash each of us were given for the road trip, Donnie, our center Travis Knight, a few others and I found our way to Times Square. Seeing the hordes of people and the bright lights, I can say without exaggeration, was one of the first times I felt truly alive. There, we came upon the type of character you could find only in New York. He was operating a shell game, you know, where you hide a small ball under a cap. One look at the group of us, deer in the headlights teenagers from the boonies, and the dollar signs in his head lit up. Especially when he saw Travis, a white dude. "Does anybody know where the ball is?" the guy asked. Travis bit. "I know where it is," he said. Travis pointed and the ball was right where he said it was. He thought he was so smart. The guy, of course, had the big fella on the hook now. He moved the caps around and asked again. "Do you know where the ball is?" Travis didn't hesitate. "I know." Except this time, before he would lift the caps, he told Travis he'd hand him $60 if he got it right. Travis naturally would have to give him $60 if he got it wrong. "No, no, no, I'm out of this," he insisted. We insisted otherwise. Well, Donnie did. He somehow got Travis to open his wallet, and when he did, Donnie took the $60 and placed it on the table. I don't have to tell you that was the last Travis ever saw of that $60. The ball, obviously, was under a different cap. Travis looked as if he was going to cry. Welcome to New York City, boys. Hey, At least Travis and the rest of us avoided any real trouble that day and left the city in an excellent mood, the St. John's victory keeping us undefeated in the conference. We kept rolling from there, and although we were knocked off by Providence in the Big East semis, we finished 27-4 and were awarded the number 2 seed in the NCAA Tournament East Regional. A national championship was not out of the question. There is, however, absolutely no margin for error in March Madness. Mess up in any way at the wrong time, a turnover, an ill-advised shot, a failure to box out your man, etc., and you're likely to be going home. And I don't care how much talent you have. That's what happened to us in the regional semifinal against Florida. It was a battle the entire way, but with just 3.4 seconds to go, we were in position to win the game and move on. Danielle, our can't-miss NBA prospect, was about to shoot 2 free throws, the score tied at 57. A few months earlier, he set a conference record with the most free throws in a game, hitting 20 of 20. Once he knocked down these 2, or just 1, we'd only have to make sure that nobody pulled a Christian Laettner on us, and we'd secure a spot in the Elite 8. Danielle missed the first, and the Gators called a timeout. No problem. Icing a big-time player like Danielle wouldn't do any good. He missed, naturally, and we lost, 69-60 in overtime. Losing was difficult enough, but then we had to deal with a report in the school newspaper that Danielle had been out partying the night before in Coconut Grove, an upscale Miami neighborhood. Even if it were true, and I'm not suggesting it was, it would not have been why he missed the free throws. Our game didn't begin until 10 the following night. Danielle just missed them, plain and simple. Either way, I didn't let the loss keep me down for long. Given how dedicated our coaches were, I was convinced we'd return in the fall stronger than ever. Although I came off the bench the entire season, I still received plenty of playing time and ended up as the second leading scorer behind Danielle. The effort I gave in practice had paid off, and for that, Coach Calhoun deserves a ton of credit. It wasn't just what he put us through day after day. It was what he said to me on one particular day that got through like nothing else. I was walking off the court with a couple of teammates when he pulled me aside. It had been another long, exhausting workout, and I was looking forward to a little downtime. "Did you make 100% of your shots today?" Coach asked. "Excuse me, did I do what?" "Did you make 100% of your shots?" What was I to tell him? "Sure, Coach, I was perfect, just like I'm perfect every day. I'm actually insulted you didn't notice." All kidding aside, his point was impossible to miss. If I was so intent on being a special player in college and hopefully at the next level, I would have to make sacrifices others weren't willing to make. "No," I told him, "I didn't make 100% of my shots." He grinned and didn't say another word. I told the guys I'd see them later, went back on the court, and, with a ball boy helping out, took shots for another half hour. From that day forward, I took shots every day after practice officially ended. Would I have preferred to go off with my teammates? No question. But I didn't want to look back someday and ask, what if I had put the extra hours in? For example, there was my roommate during freshman year, Kirk King, a 6'8" forward from Louisiana. Kirk, also a freshman, had a body like a tight end. There was greater anticipation about him coming to Connecticut than there was about me. But while I stayed in the dorm every night, resting or hitting the books, he often felt the need to be somewhere else. And because of his split focus, there have probably been times when Kirk, who didn't make it to the NBA, asks himself, "What if?" I know that would have haunted me forever. Of course, there were occasions that first year when I wasn't pleased with how I handled the ball, so I decided to take the ball with me everywhere. Seriously, it didn't leave my side. In junior high, you may remember I dribbled the ball day after day in the yard and across the street. That was nothing compared to what I did this time. I took the ball to class, to the cafeteria, to parties, to bed, I kid you not. I came up with the idea from a movie I saw where a running back prone to fumbling carries the football with him wherever he goes so he'll become more comfortable with it during games. It worked. My ball handling improved, which led to me getting off better shots. In the next game against Hartford, I scored 28 points, a career high, going 11 of 20 from the field. Although it might have looked strange to teachers and students alike, what did I care? I was on a mission. The summer after freshman year, I took part in the U.S. Olympic Festival in St. Louis. I scored 28 in the opener, making 4 of 7 three-pointers, and got 12 rebounds. I was only getting started. We won the silver medal, and I was the festival's leading scorer, breaking a record set by none other than Shaquille O'Neal. It gave me a huge boost. I was confident that if I had to, I could carry a team. I wouldn't have to. Not yet, anyway. While we lost Danielle, who skipped his senior season to turn pro, we were loaded with Kevin and Donnie, now seniors. I was expected, however, to take on more of the scoring burden, a challenge I looked forward to. Speaking of challenges, we got a big one in our second game against the Duke Blue Devils. We were the underdog. They were Duke. We were Connecticut. Nothing more needs to be said. Except this. UConn 90, Duke 86. I led us with 26 points, Kevin adding 24. We were a step ahead of them the whole way. If only that week had gone more smoothly for me away from the court. Since the game at the Palace of Auburn Hills in Michigan was set for a Tuesday, we left stores on Monday, which meant I would have to miss a biology exam. No problem. I'd make it up when I got back. Big problem. The teacher told me I couldn't make it up no matter what my excuse was, and by flunking the exam, which was a large percentage of the grade, I flunked the class. Worse yet, I was put on academic probation. Never could I have imagined this would happen to me. I put a lot of time into my studies. I wasn't worried they'd take away my scholarship, although I understood I was being watched closely. And if I didn't keep my grades up, I could be in trouble. To be safe, I made arrangements to take several classes in the summer. Meanwhile, the win against Duke was not an aberration. Over the next couple of months, we didn't lose once, rising to number 2 in the country. We were proud of ourselves, but didn't get too carried away. I never heard any of us talk about being the first team since Bobby Knight's Indiana squad in 1975-1976 to go undefeated. We knew we could lose to anyone, at any time. It happened in January, when Kansas crushed us 88-59 in Kansas City. They grabbed a 20-point lead at halftime and didn't look back. We shot a horrible 26% from the field, and our press, for a change, didn't disrupt the other team's rhythm one bit. So we lost. Every team loses. Not every team, however, has Jim Calhoun as its coach, and Jim Calhoun hated losing as much as anyone I've been around. Coach took it as a personal insult. To that man, everything was about competing, and not just in the games. In practice, he set up one-on-one free throw shooting contests, the first player to 20 being the winner. I can't overstate how much I wanted to beat my opponent, because if I didn't, Coach would banish me to the opposite end of the court with the other losers. It was not a good feeling. The winners would remain with him. If that weren't humiliating enough, then came the inevitable ribbing. Coach was a master at that. "I see you couldn't beat KO, Kevin Ollie, today, huh?" he would say. "That's not like you to be down there with the others. You're not supposed to lose." His objective was to teach us to take losing as personally as he did. And guess what? He succeeded. For my teammates, the first practice after the Kansas defeat was a killer. I got off rather easy. I had twisted my ankle, so instead of practicing, I received treatment in the locker room. Hearing coach yelling at everyone in the gym, I had never been so grateful to be away from the action. The tough love worked. We won 8 of our last 10 to finish 23-3 and found ourselves, if briefly, the number one team in the country. Although Villanova beat us handily in the Big East tournament final, we felt good about our chances heading into the tournament that mattered most, the Big Dance. Except once again, we came up short, losing to UCLA 102-96 in the Elite Eight. The loss wasn't as painful as the loss to Florida the season before. We had lost to a worse team. But the fact that the Bruins went on to win the national championship made it hurt even less. I also had nothing to be ashamed of. I scored 36 points, 18 in each half, in what was, to that point, the biggest game of my life. In the weeks that followed, I began to hear whispers that I should forego my last 2 years of college and make myself eligible for the NBA draft. One story floating out there was that I would be a definite lottery pick if I declared. Whether that was true or not, the idea of going pro did not enter my mind for a second. No matter the amount of money I stood to earn, I was having too much fun to think about leaving the college environment just yet. I would have the rest of my life to be in the real world. I still had a lot to learn. If you go to the NBA, you better be good right away, or you might find yourself out of a job in a year or two. Then what? It boggles my mind whenever I hear of players who declare for the draft, even if they're not projected to be higher than a second-round pick. Imagine what another year in college could do for their games and for their lives, because once they leave college, now they're really on their own. One afternoon, I was in the gym with a teammate who seemed eager to work out with me. That was until his girlfriend showed up as we were shooting jumpers. "Babe, I need you to take me to work," she told him. "We have to leave now or I'm going to be late." Without the slightest resistance, he put the ball on the floor and began to get dressed. I couldn't believe it. "Dude, this is your job," I said. "You can't walk out like this." And because I'm telling this story, you are right in assuming that he didn't listen to me. It should also come as no shock that he eventually transferred to another school. After he left that day, I remained in the gym for another hour or so. You see, it is not enough just to arrive early. You also must stick around until your work is done. 6. Setting the stage. Two relationships that meant a lot to me both came to an end around the same time in my sophomore year. One was the relationship with Rosalind, my first love. She said she wanted to see other people. I knew how she felt. In college, I met women almost every day who wanted to conquer the world. That wasn't Rosalind. She was content just where she was. And there's nothing wrong with that. Except I saw a different future for myself. It was unfortunate Tierra would never have both parents in the same house, but she'd have my unconditional love and support, as well as her mother's, and that's a lot more than many kids have. The other relationship was between Mom and Dad. I was in my dorm room when I heard the news they were filing for divorce, and my initial reaction was, "It's about time." They had tried for years to recapture whatever it was the two of them once had, and they couldn't try forever. There was no point in taking any sides. Dad wasn't perfect. Neither was Mom. If you think these changes set me back for a second, you should know better by now. My junior year would be the toughest yet, but my attitude was equally tough. Bring it on. For once, I wanted to be the player other teams designed their defenses around. Only then, in how I responded to the attention, and often being double-teamed, would I find out what I was truly made of. If I couldn't handle the pressure in college, it wouldn't say a lot for my prospects as a pro. I wasn't exactly the man sophomore year. I averaged 21 points, but teams did not set out to stop me specifically. Donnie and Duran, each averaging in double figures, also had to be accounted for. I was still sneaking up on people, even in the NCAA tournament. That wouldn't be the case my junior year. I knew I'd have to be even more dedicated to my craft, so I moved from the dorm to an off-campus apartment. I loved dorm life. It was exactly how it looked in the movies, hanging out in one another's rooms, just talking about classes, friends, music, whatever came up. I lived on the fourth floor, which was all male, while the floors above and below us were all female. Now, however, as I became more known, hanging out wasn't as simple as it was freshman or sophomore year. Students asked me practically every day to sign one thing or another. That got old fast. I needed my own space. Mind you, not entirely my own. I had a roommate, Travis Knight. You remember Travis. Last time we saw him, he was out $60. Another poor victim of the Big Apple. Travis was a wonderful guy, but let's just say he wasn't the neatest person in the world, and I'm obsessed with neatness. If I'm on the golf course and see a gum wrapper on the fairway, I'll go out of my way to put it in the trash. I've never been officially diagnosed, but it wouldn't shock me to learn I have a mild case of OCD. Travis drove me crazy. He always left his dirty dishes in the sink. "Wash your dishes," I kept telling him, but he didn't listen. "Next time you do it," I promised, "I'm going to put the dishes on your bed." One evening, he came home with a girl he was trying to impress and found a pile of dishes precisely where I told him they would be. Travis took it like a true sport, though, and never left a dirty dish in the sink again. My nature was to try to get along with everyone. I didn't always succeed. The summer before, I was a member of the U.S. team at the World University Games in Japan. That was some team, with Tim Duncan, Othella Harrington, Chucky Atkins, and Austin Crozier, who would all go on to play in the NBA. Oh, and a guy by the name of Allen Iverson from Georgetown. He and I didn't have any problems until the night, strangely enough, we won the gold medal. Afterward, we were eager to celebrate, he more than anyone. "We leave in the morning," Iverson told the rest of us, "so no one had better go to sleep. No one." "So who passes out as soon as he gets back to the dorm?" "You guessed it." I suggested that we put peanut butter and shampoo all over Iverson's hands and face. There was no shortage of volunteers. Except Iverson ruined our plan by waking up before we were finished, and he wanted revenge, which he got on everyone else until it came time to go after me. Soon, he and I were wrestling on the floor, punches being exchanged. Believe it or not, he was seriously trying to hurt me. Before I knew it, he grabbed a fire extinguisher and swung it at me. I ducked just in time. My idol, Muhammad Ali, would have been proud. "I'm going to get you back," Iverson vowed. "Dude," I said, "it was just a game." Somehow, I didn't think I got through to him. He and I would have our battles over the years, on the court, thankfully. Some people may have gotten the idea that we hated each other. That's how intense those battles were. Nonsense. He wanted to beat me, and I wanted to beat him. And that's how it should be. My junior year began the same way as the previous 2 years, with us as hot as any team in the nation. After falling in our second game to number 10 Iowa, 101-95 in overtime, we beat number 23 Indiana by 34 points and Northeastern by 47. By mid-February, we stood at 24-1, including 14-0 in the conference. Then, at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland, came the duel between number 3 UConn and number 11 Georgetown, and yours truly and Allen Iverson. The Hoyas, to be sure, were far from a one-man team, as were we, and their coach was one of the best, John Thompson. Nearly 7 feet tall, He intimidated the hell out of you, and his players took on his personality, especially on the defensive end, hounding you from one end of the court to the other. Like Coach Calhoun, he would have made a tremendous general. Coach Thompson got the better of us on that occasion. Georgetown 77, Connecticut 65. It was their press that won it for them, forcing us to commit 20 turnovers. On the offensive side, it was all Iverson. 26 points and 6 assists. I hit just 5 of 18, tying a season low with 13 points. Less than a month later, we faced Georgetown again in the Big East tournament final at the Garden. The winner, in addition to bragging rights, will get a boost going into the Big Dance, set to begin a few days later. We played better in that game. I mean, we couldn't play worse, and trailed by only 4 points at the half. Even so, with about 4.5 minutes to go, the Hoyas were up by 11. We needed a spark, and quickly. And we got one from Kirk King. Kirk made 2 baskets and 2 free throws to cut the deficit to 5. Several possessions later, he scored on an emphatic dunk to slice it to 1. When the Hoyas went to the free throw line and missed the front end of a 1-and-1, we had the ball with 44 seconds left. Coach Calhoun called time. In the huddle, he didn't waver for a second. "I'm going to Ray," he said. My first thought? He believes in me. Not that I felt he didn't, but from time to time it helps to get confirmation. Most important, he believed in me even though other guys, like Kirk and Ricky Moore, our freshman guard, were having much better games. I was 4 of 19, having missed my last 14 in a row. Nobody would have blamed him if he were to go with someone who had a hot hand. "Ray, you'll come off the screen, and then you'll have the whole side to operate," Coach said. Once he had confidence in me, no way was I going to let him and the team down. With 18 seconds left, I got the ball from Ricky, turned to the right, and drove in the direction of the basket. Iverson bumped me while Jerome Williams, the Georgetown forward, edged over to help. I thought for a split second about getting it to Rudy Johnson, my teammate, who was open in the corner, but he pulled his hands back when Williams moved toward him, anticipating the pass. Now I was in trouble, in the air and off balance. So with no other option, I threw it up in the vicinity of the hoop, and to my everlasting good fortune, the ball bounced off the rim, then the backboard, and in. Connecticut 75, Georgetown, 74. It wasn't over yet. There were 14 seconds to go. An eternity for Allen Iverson. Say what you want about his erratic behavior. Everybody remembers his rant about practice. But I can't think of a player who was more fearless. Only 6 feet tall at most, he had a lot to prove, and year after year he did. Iverson missed that time, thank goodness. A fadeaway behind the free throw line. Williams grabbed the rebound and had a great chance from just a few feet away. But he too missed. Then it was over. In those final 4.5 minutes, we outscored the Hoyas 12-0. We were the Big East champs. The title we craved most was next. And as the number one seed in the Southeast Regional in Indianapolis, we couldn't have felt more confident. You wouldn't know it by how we played in the first 2 rounds. Yes, we got past Colgate and Eastern Michigan to reach the Sweet 16 for the 3rd year in a row, but if we didn't pick up our game, we would come up short once again. From Indianapolis, we went, ironically, to Lexington. Once upon a time, it looked like I might play in a lot of big games at Rupp Arena. Now, if we could win the next 2, Rupp would forever be the place where I booked my ticket to the Final Four. First, we had to get by the number 5 seed, the Mississippi State Bulldogs, which was no given. This was the team that had stunned Kentucky a few weeks before in the SEC Tournament Championship game. They had 4 players averaging double figures, including Eric Dampier, their 6'11 center who would spend 16 years in the NBA. As it turned out, their guard, Darryl Wilson, was the one who killed us. he hit 5 3-pointers in a row, 7 altogether, scoring 27 points in a 60-55 win. I killed us as well, making only 9 of 25, the most crucial miss with 12 seconds to go, when I had a decent look at a 3 that would have tied the game. I also missed both of my free throws. Like the loss to Florida 2 years earlier, this one hurt. It was a game we should have won, though I have often asked myself, did we want to win? Nonsense, you say. Of course you wanted to win. Maybe, but a part of us wanted to go home, which is what we should have done between the games in Indianapolis and Lexington. Coach was looking to avoid any distractions, though, and that's why we stayed away. I can see his point, but sometimes you need a pat on the back, and we would have gotten that on campus. What does this have to do with the way we played? Impossible to say, but I can tell you that after the game, the guys were as happy to go to stores as they would have been to stay on the road for another couple of days, and you can't split your focus if you hope to win a championship. In any case, what the future would hold was not on my mind as I got off the court at Rupp. Clearly, however, it was on the mind of Stephon Marbury, whose Georgia Tech team was about to take on Cincinnati in the next game. See you in the draft, Stephon told me. Meanwhile, I went to class like everybody else. I was a student athlete, not an athlete student. At least that was the plan. Every time I showed up, though, the other students gave me funny looks. Why are you here? They asked. Heck, even the professors were puzzled. A week or so later, it finally hit me. Why was I here? By this point, all anybody wanted to know was if I was going to turn pro or come back for my senior year. It reminded me of high school when everyone kept asking where I was going to college. To many, there was no doubt. Ray, you are a Big East Player of the Year. You're one of the best guards in the country. You will be a top 5 pick in the draft. You'll be set for life. How can you not go? Everything they said was true. But first, I wanted to see if I could make the case to stay. One person who didn't hesitate to make it was Jim Calhoun. You don't want to go yet, Coach told me. You'll be with a lot of grown men hanging out doing God knows what. Plus, you could certainly use another year in college to get better. I looked up to Coach Calhoun and appreciated what he was saying. Whenever I strayed, even a little, from doing what I needed to improve my game, did you make 100% of your shots today? He was there to set me straight. None of what happened later could have happened without him. Plus, I didn't doubt for a moment he was telling me the truth. You can always get better. On the other hand, my family wanted me to turn pro, though Mom said she would be pleased with whatever I decided. God bless her. The days flew by. At times, I felt I was close to announcing my decision. Others, I wasn't so sure. Then came the day that made it clearer to me than ever, and from a most unlikely source. I was walking on campus when I bumped into my former anthropology professor, an expert on the draft he was not. Mr. Allen, what are you doing with your future? He asked. I don't know, I told him. Mr. Allen, look around you, he went on. This university has been here since the 1800s, and I'm quite sure this university will be here long after you're gone. That's all he said, but it was enough. For the longest time, I worried people might think poorly of me if I chose making money over getting my degree, but he made me see I could earn a degree anytime. Besides, there has always been a stigma attached to the black athlete who leaves college early. Who was the last white athlete to be put down for taking the money? In the end, there was no case I could make to stay. I could only make the case to go. Leaving Connecticut was difficult. I had shown up at the airport in Hartford 3 years earlier with a trash bag full of clothes, $200 in my pocket, and no guarantees. Now, after the work I put in, and the lessons I learned from Coach Calhoun and his staff, I was going out into the world with a chance to live my dream. But it was more than that. They taught me to be a man, not just a basketball player. For that, I will be forever grateful. The bonds I created with my teammates were the strongest of my life, and still are. We came from different parts of the country, and although we'd reached a certain level of success before we got there, there was still a lot to learn. The learning didn't come easy, and for each of us, there were times we didn't think it would ever come. In those times, we were there for one another. Always. Sure, I wished we had played in a Final Four. We certainly had our chances. If Danielle had made one of the free throws against Florida, if UCLA hadn't been on a roll, if I had hit the three against Mississippi State. Coach used to tell us you have to be lucky to get there. We weren't. Yet, even if I'd been in a Final Four with Kentucky or another school with a rich tradition, I wouldn't have the satisfaction I do today from playing for UConn. I helped build something special. In the spring of 1999, I was in the stands at Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg, Florida, when the Huskies captured the first of their four national championships, beating Duke 77-74. I felt a part of that triumph belonged to me and the men I played with. The decision to go to UConn and, 3 years later, to leave UConn was mine and mine alone. Now, however, by putting my name in the 1996 NBA draft, I'd be back where I was as a kid, going where someone told me to go. Barring a trade, it would be one of four cities: Philadelphia, Toronto, Vancouver, or Milwaukee, the teams with the first four selections. No one figured I would last any longer. In the days leading up to the big day, June 26th, I visited each place so that the teams could put me through a workout. It was one thing to see a player on film, another to see him in the flesh, warts and all. The importance of making the right decision can't be overstated. The wrong one can set a franchise back years and cost a general manager his job. Two visits stood out: Toronto for what did not happen, and Milwaukee for what did. In Toronto, I met with the legendary Pistons guard, Isaiah Thomas, a part owner and executive with the Raptors. "I want to see you run from here to there," Isaiah said, pointing to a spot on the court about 30 yards away. "Whatever you say, Mr. Thomas." Once I got there, I awaited further instructions. They never came. "I don't need you to do anything else," he said. "I know what you can do." Well, that certainly didn't make me believe I'd end up in Toronto. If you're going to invest a lot of money into your so-called player of the future, you better see every part of his skill set. The NBA doesn't give you do-overs. If you think the Toronto workout was out of the ordinary, wait till you hear what happened in Milwaukee. Shortly after I got to the practice facility, Mike Dunleavy, the team's GM, asked me to play a game of one-on-one against Chris Robinson, a guard from Western Kentucky who the Bucks were thinking about picking in the second round. No problem. While playing one-on-one is hardly the fairest test of an individual's value in a team game, I figured Dunleavy might learn a thing or two about me he would not spot in other drills. Chris had a flight to catch, so I knew we wouldn't play for long. We went at each other pretty hard. Once Chris took off, I figured Dunleavy would put me through a more conventional workout. "Guess again." "Let's play. You and I," he said. "You and I?" Was he out of his mind? Mike Dunleavy had been a decent player in his day, except his day was long gone. He was 42. What he could possibly gain from playing someone half his age, I didn't have a clue. Whatever he was thinking, I couldn't say no, could I? And no, I don't remember the score, if there was one. Afterward, I met with Senator Herb Cole, who owned the team. The senator and I hit it off, but as I left town, I was still trying to figure out what Dunleavy had been up to. In any case, That was it for my visits. Minnesota, picking fifth, asked me at the last minute to come in for a workout, but I declined. My family was already in New York for the draft, which was to take place in New Jersey. Besides, the Timberwolves had a talented young shooting guard, J.R. Ryder. They didn't need me. One team that did was the Boston Celtics at number 6. I was in my hotel room just hours before the draft when a call came from Red Auerbach, the president of the Celtics. Red was the Celtics, dating back to the early 1950s before they started winning championships, 8 in a row at one point. He said they would take me if I was still on the board. I was blown away. Whatever my fate might be, I didn't have to wait long. I took a seat in the green room at the Continental Airlines Arena with the others whose lives were about to change forever. Around 7:30 p.m., before a national audience on TNT, Commissioner Stern walked to the podium and began to recite the names. Allen Iverson to the Sixers at number 1. No surprise there. You want to get your fan base excited? You take the most exciting young player in the game. Marcus Camby, a center from the University of Massachusetts, to Toronto at number 2. No surprise there either. The Raptors needed a big. I wondered what kind of workout Isaiah put him through. Sharif Abdur-Rahim, a small forward from Cal, to Vancouver at number 3. Good move. Sharif is a baller. The Grizzlies took the whole process extremely seriously. In my workout with them, they looked at my vertical leap and how many pounds I could bench press, and they put me through a few agility tests. From what I heard, they were that thorough with everyone. Now the proceedings were about to really get interesting. The Bucks, I assumed, would pick me in spite of the strange day I spent there. Yet the moment I heard the commissioner call out, Stephon Marbury, all I could think was, oh my God, I can't believe it. I'm going to be a Celtic. There was no way Minnesota picking right before Boston was going to take me, not after I wouldn't show up for the workout. If that's the case, I asked myself, then why are the cameramen from TNT rushing to my table? They knew something I didn't. With the 5th pick in the 1996 NBA draft, Stern said, reading from a card, the Minnesota Timberwolves select Ray Allen from the University of Connecticut. What? Someone must have handed him the wrong card. It happens. Look at the 2017 Academy Awards. It was the right card. I was going to Minnesota, and now I had to pretend I was excited about it. I got up, handed tiara to my father, put on a Timberwolves cap, and wearing a cream suit I bought for the occasion, went to the stage to shake hands with the commissioner, smiling the whole time. Before I knew it, I was being interviewed by TNT's Craig Sager. Minnesota's a great city, I said, meaning Minneapolis, of course. They have a great organization, and I'll be ready to play there next year. Was I a good actor or what? My next interview was with a television reporter from Minnesota. Gee, how much longer would I have to keep up the charade? While I was giving another cliche answer, some league official interrupted. Sorry, but we have to pull him out of this, he said. I was taken back to the stage, where I was informed that my rights had been traded to the Bucks, with center Andrew Lang, for Marbury. Stephon and I exchanged hats in front of the cameras, and the draft went on. Some draft that was, too, with names such as Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, Derek Fisher, and Antoine Walker. You'd think I'd be relieved, wouldn't you? Milwaukee being a lot better than, for heaven's sake, Minnesota? I wasn't. 30 minutes into my NBA career, and already somebody didn't want me. I felt even worse when I found out fans who showed up to watch the draft at the Bradley Center in Milwaukee, where the Bucks played, booed the deal. This was the Midwest, where people knew nothing about the Big East. They knew plenty about Stephon, on the other hand, and the street basketball he played in the ACC. Once I returned to the hotel, I began to cry. My family couldn't figure out what was wrong. Don't you want to celebrate? They asked. Celebrate what? Being traded? Being booed? The biggest night of my life, and I couldn't remember when I felt as devastated. I needed to get the hell out of there. I'd go for a drive, but not by myself. I'd pick up someone I met the day before. Shannon and I met at the All-Star Cafe in Manhattan, where I went for a party related to the draft. I'd never seen anyone so beautiful. Our first conversation didn't last long, but when I found out she was going afterward to the same club I was going to, fate always plays a role in romance, doesn't it? I asked her to save a dance for me. She said she would. I liked everything about her, including the fact that she knew nothing about basketball. Tomorrow I'm getting drafted, I told Shannon. I didn't know we were at war, she said. I swear she wasn't trying to be funny. We had that dance, she promised, and talked until it got late, and we both had to go. Me to get ready for my big day, and she for hers. Shannon was a singer for an R&B group, Shades, and her first single released by Motown was hitting the stores. How fitting. I said goodnight and told her I'd call the next day. Now the next day was here. As soon as I walked off the stage in New Jersey, I found a phone. I have to see you right away, I told her. I can't leave town without seeing you. I picked up Shannon at her apartment, and we drove to the pier in Jersey City to talk. Me to talk, that is, and I whined more than I talked. I said how awesome it would have been if the Celtics had chosen me instead of Minnesota. She was sympathetic, to a point. You're going to live your dream? She asked. Yup. Make a lot of money? Yup. Take care of your family? Yup. She didn't want to hear another word. Buck up, Buttercup, she said. No pun intended. That's another thing I appreciated about Shannon. She didn't have a problem expressing herself. Time was getting away from us. It must have been around 2 a.m. Perhaps 3, when I dropped her back at her apartment. In a couple of hours, I would be getting on a plane to Milwaukee to start the future I'd been dreaming about since I was 14, when I saw Michael Jordan on television and knew I wanted to be just like him. 7. The buck starts here. Think Storrs, Connecticut is in the middle of nowhere? Try Oshkosh, Wisconsin, about 90 miles from Milwaukee where the Bucks held training camp. I shouldn't have been so critical. I knew how many people would have traded places with me in a second, no questions asked. All I'm suggesting is that being in the NBA was not everything it was cracked up to be. Hotel, practice, hotel, practice. You get the picture. It went on like that day after day in Oshkosh, and it was no more glamorous when camp ended and the season began. As for those parties and fancy cars and celebrities they tell you about, if that was the life of a professional basketball player, it was the life in other cities, not Milwaukee. Often, I didn't feel like I was in the league at all. We didn't draw big crowds at home, and on the road, there was no Milwaukee Bucks nation that came out to cheer us on. The Green Bay Packers owned the city and state and used to play a game or two a season in Milwaukee into the mid-1990s. I felt I was back in high school, football being the sport that people were passionate about. Whenever my teammates and I ran into folks on our way to practice, the conversations would usually go something like this. You guys are tall. You must play basketball. We sure do. So you play for Marquette? No, we play for the Bucks. That's nice. And off they went, unimpressed. After every game at the Bradley Center, I ordered a pizza and headed home to watch The X-Files. Did I know how to have a good time or what? On the road, we were the butt of jokes. All anybody knew of Milwaukee was that it was where Laverne and Shirley lived. We would hear the theme song from that sitcom whenever we ran out onto the court. That got old fast. I didn't have much fun when I was playing either. Come to think of it, it was not